Welcome to Creekside Chats with Successful Real Estate Investors, brought to you by Steve Tucker Capital, promoting prosperity and harmony to help you flourish in all areas of life. Join in as we explore the motivations and goals of real estate investors and how their ability to invest abundantly has provided them with the time and freedom to contribute to the world in a creative and thoughtful way. Now please welcome your host, Dr. Allen.
Hello, enlightened investors. Delighted to be back with you again today. I'm your host, Dr. Allen. If you're tuning in for the first time, I hope you enjoy the show. With us today is a technologist who is universally known in the real estate circles as the mad scientist of multifamily. He's a data guru, a process freak, and an outsourcing expert. He treats his $250 million multifamily portfolio as an ongoing experiment in efficiency and optimization. The mad scientist lives by two mantras. First, we can only manage what we can measure. Second, data beats gut feel by a million miles. It is a delight to have back on the show, Neil Bawa.
Thanks for having me back on the show. Last time we had such a good time and we thought maybe there's content that we didn't get to cover. So hopefully we get to pick some of that out, Alan.
First of all, you were talking before we got started about what a successful week you've had and your first foray into the world of industrial investment. So talk to us about what's going on in the world of the industrial investments, why you made that decision to do that, and where you're going from here.
In the last two and a half years, for about 4 years, we've been doing this segment, this webinar called Real Estate Trends, right? And there's a new one for every year. It's a fairly long webinar. It's about 90 minutes of content, so about 60 slides. And we basically talk about all the different trends affecting multifamily and commercial real estate. And increasingly over the last 3 years, we've seen industrial rise to the top. And if you think about it, industrial rising to the top should be no surprise to anybody. The United States, no, except for the coronavirus pandemic, usually grows at about 2%. Our economy grows at 2%. And there's sectors in the US economy that typically grow at 3%, 4%, even 5%. The only sector that grows much faster than the economy has always been e-commerce, right? That's why you notice that Amazon doubles year over year, that sort of thing. Yeah, e-commerce typically grows between 10 and 15% a year. So if you look at the US economy at 2%, e-commerce is either 5 or 7 or 8 times faster than the US economy. Any sector that is inherently connected with e-commerce is also going to grow faster than the US economy. And the industrial sector is connected to e-commerce because of warehousing, because of logistics, because of basically all of the transportation elements that go with e-commerce. Because what you're really doing with e-commerce is you're, instead of placing your goods in a big box retailer at $3 or $4 a square foot of cost, you're placing it in an industrial warehouse at 75 cents a square foot of cost. You're saving that 4X, 5X, and passing that on to the consumers. Amazon certainly does that. They just came out with their results, $89 billion in revenue for this quarter, and only about $4 to $5 billion in profits. So essentially, they're just keeping a 5% margin and pushing the rest out to the consumers. And that's why we've seen Amazon beat everyone else on cost. That was pre-pandemic. So pre-pandemic, e-commerce was growing at 5 to 7 times the US economy. Now let's talk about what happened in the last 4 to 5 months. So we just got a report that between June 2019 and May 2020, okay, so that's 12 months, the e-commerce world grew at 77% year over year. So that's roughly 40 times the speed of the US economy. And almost all of that surge was in the last 4 months. Basically, the e-commerce month, Feb, March, April, May, were the surge months. That's when e-commerce really massively surged. There's some people that are thinking, no, people are going to go back to the old ways. I'm not in that group. I'm in the group of people that the extraordinary convenience of e-commerce, right? When you make, let's say you sign up for Amazon and you weren't signed up before, now you've got like dozens of items that are in your orders list. You can go tap and click buy again, or you can use subscription services and pay even less. That's a very addictive thing. It's very difficult to go back to, you know, let's go to Walmart to just pick up a toilet roll. I believe that this surge is permanent. We have not yet seen e-commerce in the last 20 years have a year where it didn't grow massively from the previous year. So it's been a continuous, rapid, faster than US growth. And the industrial sector has benefited as a result. In fact, at the beginning of the year, when I did the trends webinar, this is pre-COVID, and I'm saying, look, I'm a multifamily guy. I don't have any industrial assets, but I can tell you that industrial is a better asset class than multifamily today. I said this bluntly in Jan, and I said, look, because nothing else, multifamily is not growing at 15% a year. Multifamily grows at 3 or 4% a year. We feel really happy about it. E-commerce grows at 15% a year. But now in the last 4 months, we, Alan, we've had 77% growth. So if it's 15% a year, that means that 5 years of e-commerce growth occurred in 4 months, 5 years worth. But in the last 4 months, we didn't build any warehouses. Most of the US was shut down. Construction activity was massively slowed. We didn't build any warehousing. So all of a sudden, you need billions more square feet of warehouse that doesn't exist. You need logistics, you need trucks, all that stuff doesn't exist yet. In the last 4 months, we made it work. It was pandemic time, people worked 24 hours a day, truckers work crazy hours, and we somehow made it work. But in the long run, we are going to need more space. The second reason why industrial is so phenomenally powerful is that the United States has been, for the last 20 years, has been a just-in-time or JIT economy. We're the world's leading JIT economy. What this means is we have 4 days of food. We have 4 days of Purell. We have 4 days of toilet paper, right? That's the total amount of stock that the United States has because we constantly, the US is supplied by thousands of cargo ships every day. So we never really needed more than 4 days worth. So it really never made sense to have more than 4 days worth of storage, except now we realize that that was a really bad idea. So at this point, we're going to go from a 4-day economy to a 10-day or a 15-day economy because local mandates, state mandates, and federal mandates are going to be, we're not going to make this mistake again. We need more supplies. We need everything from PPE to Purell. We need more water. We need more food. This pandemic really changed things, right? Mentally changed how we operate. And so I'm not saying we're not going to be a just-in-time country, but I don't think we're going to be a 4-day just-in-time country. I think it might be 6, I think it might be 10. Once again, billions of square feet of storage spaces is required. So you look at all of those pieces, right? And then you look at this phenomenon of populist politicians saying, we need to bring our supply chains back. We can't be basically this overly dependent on China, who we might get into a shooting war within the next 5 years. And that's a populist chant that I'm not so sure that's a good idea to do. Who listens to me? Bottom line is politicians can get elected by saying, I'm going to bring our supply chains back home. So even if 5% of the US supply chains come back home, that's billions of square feet of industrial. So I'm looking at this going, before COVID, it was already the investor's darling. It was number one in the US, but in pretty much any trends document that you could see. And in the last 4 months, it just becomes number one through number five. It's phenomenal. So we've been looking at it for a long time, trying to get into the asset class, failing over and over again, projects that didn't pencil out. And we finally got lucky and we did a project. We released it on Wednesday. We shared this information, this thought process with investors. It was a large raise, $6.4 million. Today is Friday. So 48 hours after our webinar, we're fully subscribed and we have people on hold. So I think folks get it. They understand that some classes, yes, multifamily overall is the best class, asset class. I believe that most people believe that. But there are times when other asset classes can grow fast.
Is the project you just got into, are you breaking ground on that or is that an existing structure?
It's new construction, but it's not the usual three years of new construction. So the management team had bought land about 2 years ago, and I was luckily bought into the management team about 7 or 8 months ago. And so they had already spent $1 million. They'd already fought the city. They had built a secondary access. Secondary access means a second road coming into the area, into that land. So they did done all of that stuff. They've submitted plans to the city. So it's completely shovel ready. It's going to break ground in 5 or 6 weeks. So also industrial is unique in that unlike multifamily new construction, you can use tilt up concrete. Mm-hmm. So what they do is basically they lay down forms on the floor and they allow them to cure for about 2 weeks. And then they use a crane and they just simply tilt them up. And those forums already have pre-built windows and doors. Everything's cut into them. And so you can build an industrial building in 9 months, where with an apartment complex, it probably would take 18 months, 20 months to build it. So it's a much faster build. You usually get cash flow in year two in industrial. We've never forecast cash flow in year two in multifamily. It's not even possible. So we usually forecast cash flow on apartments after 30 months, whereas on industrial, we can forecast it after 12 to 14 months. So it's a very different class. And there's downsides too. The industrial, the big downside is you can build it very fast, so it can get saturated very quickly.
I'm thinking, as you were talking about this, I'm thinking of all of the inner city warehouse space that is currently abandoned and vacant. And there's lots of that. In any inner city you go to, there's just
absolutely
tons.
Yep.
Have you looked at converting that, modernizing it, and compared to going from ground up?
Today, industrial vacancy is extremely low. It's in the 3 to 4% range nationwide. It hasn't dropped at all. The vacancy hasn't increased since COVID. So if there is a warehouse that at this point is abandoned or is empty, then I would say that it's out of the path of progress. The key thing with warehousing is you can't build it anywhere. You need to be close to places like an Amazon headquarters or an Amazon fulfillment center, which is probably like 2 million square feet. And there's probably 60 or 70 businesses around it that are serving it. You need to be very close to freeways, trucking access. All of that matters a lot. So if there's like Oakland, for example, there's lots of abandoned warehouses. In my mind, those warehouses are probably not appropriate for industrial conversion, but they're definitely appropriate for conversion into lofts. We've seen a lot of people take industrial space and do, you know, 12-foot ceiling lofts with exposed piping. Those look beautiful. Once you're done rehabbing them, they're gorgeous. And you got concrete walls, so there's no sound issues. I think that's a real play. I think that's what people should be doing. And obviously it's a risky play during a pandemic, but I'm not sure that those warehouses, basically, they're just out of the path of progress. The manufacturing has moved away. So nobody even considers them part of the warehousing.
You talked a lot, and on other things, I've listened to your podcast on just different various things. One of the things that you're really big on is and you just mentioned that, is the growth path, and particularly in conjunction with residential housing, that it's got to be in the growth path. And you just mentioned again, that's also important in industrial. But I'm suspecting there are different growth paths. Is that correct?
Very much. So the growth of industrial is usually tied to logistics, to transportation. So you can have a huge amount of multifamily growth in East Mesa, right? Because East Mesa is 30 or 40 minutes from Phoenix. But I suspect nobody's going to build a warehouse in East Mesa because it's not in the middle of anything. There's no freeway access. There's not a lot of construction. There's not a lot of logistics. What are you going to store there? It's a suburb. So I do think that industrial and multifamily have completely different paths, though sometimes they converge, right? There's going to be people want to live near freeways for multifamily, and industrial developers, we look for freeway access and we look for freeway crossings. So usually industrial is going to work well where two freeways cross, and not local freeways. Like in the Bay Area, you wouldn't look at 580. If you're near freeway 5 or 1, that's a huge advantage because your truck can get on and boom, you can be shooting down the interstate. And so those kinds of things matter a lot. So yeah, different paths of progress, but they're similar in that we do want to invest in industrials in areas that have high population growth and high income growth. Because most of the growth in industrial at this point is not coming from manufacturing, it's coming from e-commerce. So we need consumers with disposable income that are in our area, because somehow or the other, they're going to basically influence our warehousing space. It may not be my warehouse that has e-commerce information, e-commerce goods, but if like around me, there are 20 warehouses and 10 of them are eaten up by e-commerce, that's going to drive up the rent and I'm going to benefit from it. So there's definitely going to be benefit. So in that sense, we are looking for the path of progress, but within the path of progress, we're more sensitive to rail connections and road connections.
Well, since I live here in North Carolina, let's turn the conversation to what's going on in North Carolina and Georgia.
I've been telling people this. If you look at our trends presentation for 2016 and 2017, we picked Provo, Utah as our top city to invest in the U.S. For 2018 and 2019, we picked Boise, Idaho. And for 2020, we had a tie. This is the first time in so many years of doing real estate trends. This is a toolkit that goes out to about 60,000 people a year. We had a tie. And you'd be very interested in knowing, Alan, that the tie was Charlotte and Raleigh. I recently, I've said this a number of times, I don't know what North Carolina politicians are eating, but whatever they're eating, I want to eat it. Because so much is going right for North Carolina at this point. Raleigh, Durham, Asheville, Salem, Winston-Salem, so many areas where the numbers, the fundamentals are strengthening all at the same time, which is unusual because most of the time, if you look at any state, two or three cities have strengthening fundamentals and then two or three have, you know, declining fundamentals. But at this point, there actually isn't a major city in North Carolina that is not strengthening. And obviously, COVID has interrupted that. There's no getting around that. But I think that once we get a vaccine, I think that North Carolina is going to be one of the fastest out of the gates in terms of growth. So I think that it's phenomenal. And some of that growth is spilling over into South Carolina. I'm seeing strength in places like Columbia. And what's the beach resort that you've got when you shoot down South Carolina to the ocean? So Myrtle Beach and Charleston, I'm seeing strong growth there, seeing fundamentals develop. It's a little bubbly, that area, the growth's a bit more bubbly, where I feel like Raleigh and Charlotte are more grounded in fundamentals. But all the same, Carolinas are just seeing incredible growth. Georgia is similar, but I feel like it's more Atlanta-driven. It's not that Georgia is growing. I think it's Atlanta that is becoming a world-class city. And as people pour in and there's huge amounts of in-migration to Atlanta, that is then spreading out to the other parts of Georgia. But it's not as broad-based, where the North Carolina seems to have just extraordinary broad-based growth. Even quiet cities like Asheville, nothing was going on in Asheville for 10 or 20 years. And all of a sudden now it's just people are building left and right. And again, when this sort of thing happens, usually you say it's a boom, it's going to be a bust, but the fundamentals appear to be increasing at the same rate as new construction. So it doesn't seem like it's getting out of control or overheating.
That is very interesting. And you were talking about the areas between two cities and that Charlotte and Raleigh are actually too far apart to be taking advantage of that. But you just mentioned Winston-Salem, and I'm thinking Winston-Salem and Raleigh. That's got to be a pretty high growth area between the two of those cities.
How far is Charlotte from Winston-Salem?
I think
maybe 3 hours.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
That's again too far for compression. Yeah. So usually for Winston-Salem to have compression benefits, it would need to be about an hour from one of the two cities and then about 2 hours from the other. So for example, Lakeland is a compression city that I talk about often in Florida. Lakeland's about an hour from Tampa and about 50 minutes from Orlando. So it's being compressed from both sides. Mm-hmm. To me, Winston-Salem's a little bit too far from Raleigh and definitely too far from Charlotte to be considered a compression city. So whatever's going on there is probably based on their own fundamentals, not necessarily based on what is happening. Obviously, there's some all ships rising effect when the whole state is moving up, but not from a compression methodology. I wouldn't say that.
What do you have on your plate now that you have successfully closed this last syndication? Where are you moving on from here?
So for the moment, we feel like we need to wait on value add. And I know so many people are continuing, they're moving forward, they're buying value add. Good luck to you. Nothing wrong with that. But here's how I look at it. We all love multifamily value add. This is my bread and butter and it'll stay there. But the way I look at it is this: the pandemic hit the multifamily rent rolls for the first time in April. April was a bad month for multifamily, and then May was a little better, and then June was even a little better, and July seemed to be like June. But there is certainly, if you look across the board in the US, rents have gone down a little bit. So Class A rents have gone down maybe 1%, Class C rents are up maybe 1%, but they've certainly slowed. And then on the other hand, you've got delinquencies that have spiked in Class C. There's a lot of tenants not paying. I've got tenants that are not paying. And so net operating income which is what is used to calculate the pricing more than any other number, has declined. And it's probably gone down maybe 10%, 15%. And so the way I see it is, people come back to me and say, so if NOI has declined 15%, why aren't prices down 15%? My answer is, because it's only gone down 15% for 3 months, April, May, and June. So then people are like, oh, okay. So it's 15% annualized, but it's only 3 months that have happened. So that should lead to about 3 or 4% price decline. I'm like, yes. And have you noticed prices are down about 3 or 4%? You're like, okay, so what'll happen next month? They have to go down about another 0.5%. So maybe that'll be 4.5% next month. And then the month after that, they'll be 5% down, then 5.5, then 6. Because each month as time goes on, now when you're looking at a T12, right? Now you're looking at 5 impacted months, then 6, then 7, then 8. So if you think about it, the most perfect time to buy multifamily is going to be next year in April, when you've now had 12 months of post-COVID impact the net operating income, and you can only, sellers can only so much say, yeah, but it's going to get better when you get a vaccine, blah, 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 so you have to pay me more. Yeah, there's a little bit of that, but not too much. So to me, I think that I'd love to be buying multifamily, a lot of multifamily in that April timeframe next year. I don't want to wait too long, because if there's a vaccine and the market starts picking up, then I don't get to buy that dip. So Q1 next year, I'm really going to be focused on multifamily. That's when I think the time's right. But Q4, I don't think we're going to be doing a lot of multifamily. We might do some. Obviously, there's deals. There are some sellers who are getting distressed. So, you know, you make offers, and I think most of our offers are going to be thrown out. But every once in a while, we might get lucky. But we're not expending a huge amount of energy. We're doing new construction projects because we have a huge, unique advantage. We have lenders that have worked with us before. We have a track record, and new construction pricing, their lending is just incredibly cheap right now. We're actually getting quoted 4% for new construction loans on $20 million loans. It's bizarrely good. Plus, I get to skip a year. I get to skip this whole crazy year and come out on the other side, the post-vaccine side of this, which in my mind, the economic condition would certainly look better. It may not look like Feb. I certainly don't expect that to happen for several years. But I think that a year from now, the economic conditions do look better than today. People are going back out. They have that mental feeling of freedom again, and tourism starts, international tourism starts. I think it looks better. So when I do new construction, I get to skip it. So I'm building quadplexes. And why am I building quadplexes? I was building 240 unit plexes, if you want to call them that, in December. So why build quadplexes now? The answer is I'm not building one quadplex, I'm building 15 at a time. So these are fairly large projects. But what's nice is that quadplexes today, even when you build collections of them and a bank gives you one loan, the bank underwrites it as 15 quadplexes, because if something goes back and the bank repossesses, they can sell quadplexes really easily. Those are non-commercial loans, and there's a million people that want to buy brand new construction quadplexes. So the bank is very easy with loans. And, oh yeah, these are quadplexes. It doesn't matter. We can sell them if something goes back. But no bank wants to hold a 240-unit construction project if it's empty. A quadplex only has 4 tenants. How difficult can it be to lease it out for a bank? So basically what I'm doing is I'm pivoting to something that makes more sense to banks in a pandemic and building those.
It's just amazing to me how you think through all of these things.
I'm just trying to poke holes in everything. That's what I am. You look at me, I'm an experimenter that's saying, how can I cheat? How can I cheat? How can I cheat? Right? Can I use numbers to cheat? Can I use, when I mean cheat, it's not do something that's unethical, but finding a shortcut to something, right? Figuring out, like for example, right now, the Real Focus system that I invented 5 years ago, about 40, 50,000 people are using it. It pointed to a bunch of cities. And I can tell you, post-pandemic, my cities are doing great. The Salt Lake City project, we've been looking at it for 7 months. It's actually north of Salt Lake City, so it's about 10 minutes north of Salt Lake City. That county, Davis County, has 4.7% unemployment post-COVID. Most counties in the U.S. would kill to have 4.7% unemployment pre-COVID. So it's phenomenal to see how they haven't been affected by this. They've had one death a month in that county. So very little impact. And so we love the fact that our data has pointed us in the right direction. Mesa, Arizona has the second highest rent growth in the United States post-COVID. So my 240 unit, its financing is not affected.
Great. We're coming to the end of our time once again. Tell the folks how they can get in touch with you, and not only to get in touch with you, but how they can find these podcasts that go into all of these various different numbers we've been talking about.
I talk about data analytics. I talk about systems to manage your properties. I also talk about use a virtual assistant to 10x your business. All of these are available by, and it's really simple. I happen to be the only Neal Bawa on the internet. So if you type in N-E-A-L, and then the last name, Bawa, B-A-W-A, and just hit enter in Google, you'll find several hundred podcasts and conference sessions where I'm teaching in a conference. And most of these are videos, but you get lots of them also have interactive content. There's a course, a very popular course that I teach on udemy.com. You can look that up. But the best way to really interact with not just me, but everyone else that is in my sphere of influence that are data experts is Multifamily University. So you can actually, if you're watching this as a video, you can see behind me the Multifamily University logo. So if you go to multifamilyu.com, you'll notice that we do 40 webinars a year. They're very deep dive. They're fairly long, often 90 minutes long, and they dive deep into an area. So for example, we have a town hall coming up next week, which is the impact of COVID on student housing nationwide. So we're bringing in two superstars. One of them has managed 4,000 units. The other one has managed 100,000 beds. And both of those are true experts in their realm. They're both phenomenal. And luckily, I'm happy to say that they're both partnered with me. So they're going to come in and tell me what's happening in the student housing realm. A few weeks ago, we did industrial. A few weeks before that, we talked about various topics like senior housing. We did public storage. So these are very powerful events, and you can go to multifamilyu.com and watch them. There's no fee, no subscription. It's all meant to be free. We have about between 50 and 75,000 people a year that watch our events.
Neal, it's just been a pleasure once again having you, and thank you for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Alan. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Creekside Chats with Successful Real Estate Investors, brought to you by Steed Talker Capital. For more information, as well as access to our free ebook on enhancing your well-being through real estate investing, be sure to connect with us at steedtalker.com. As part of our efforts to make the world a better place, Steed Talker Capital contributes to activities and organizations committed to better understand the equine and enhance the humane treatment of horses worldwide. Steed Talker Capital, working for a world where all creatures, great and small, flourish abundantly. Connect with us at steedtalker.com.